From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Marijuana can get you fired, even when it's legal. I'm Judy Muller, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The whole country's watching Washington State and Colorado to see how their laws legalizing marijuana work out. But the federal government still considers pot to be an illegal substance, and employers are caught in the middle. Should they follow federal or state law? Do workers know they can still be fired for lighting up, even if it's off the job? It happened to a man in Colorado, a quadriplegic using medical marijuana at home for his pain. Is his case a cautionary tale? On today's Talking Point, Hollywood seems to be in love with despicable characters. One critic calls it a shameless trend. Now the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
I'm Judy Muller, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with To the Point. Coming up, legal use of marijuana does not mean you can't be fired from your job for lighting up, even in the privacy of your own home. Two states, Washington and Colorado, have passed laws legalizing marijuana for recreational use. Alaska may have a similar measure on its August ballot. And more than 20 states allow medical marijuana use. And yet, employers still have the right in many states to fire workers who test positive for marijuana, regardless of legality. On today's Talking Point, television series are suddenly teeming with self-absorbed petty characters. Why do we like them so much? First, this news update. The Obama administration today said it would recognize as lawful the marriages of some 1,300 same-sex couples in Utah. This comes after the state of Utah said it would refuse to do so. Attorney General Eric Holder posted a video on the Justice Department's website to make the announcement.
These families should not be asked to endure uncertainty regarding their status as the litigation unfolds. In the days ahead, we will continue to coordinate across the federal government to ensure the timely provision of every federal benefit to which Utah couples and couples throughout the country are entitled, regardless of whether they are in same-sex or opposite-sex marriages.
The legal whiplash for same-sex couples in Utah began in December when a federal district judge ruled that Utah's constitutional amendment limiting marriage to one man and one woman violated the federal constitution. That prompted a flood of same-sex marriages in the traditionally conservative state. Utah appealed for a stay, and on Monday of this week, the Supreme Court granted that stay. Then on Wednesday, the state of Utah said it would not recognize the marriages that had already taken place. Today's announcement from the Obama administration is a strong denouncement of that action. And joining me now, Doug Najame, attorney and professor of law at UC Irvine. Welcome, Doug.
Thank you.
Why did the administration decide to wade into this legal whipsaw in Utah, do you think?
Well, the administration was going to have to get involved because after the Supreme Court struck down DOMA, the federal government began, of course, to give federal rights and benefits to married same-sex couples, including to couples who married in a state that allowed them to get married but actually resided in a state that didn't recognize their marriage. So there were already couples in Utah that could have gone to California, for instance, gotten a marriage license, gotten married in California, returned to Utah, which didn't recognize their marriage, and get some federal rights and benefits because of the policy decisions of some administrative agencies after DOMA was struck down.
Well, what does this mean for those couples in Utah now?
Yes. So the couples who got the marriage licenses after the district court judge issued his opinion in December, and they then had valid marriage licenses, they will get federal rights and benefits across the board from the federal government, which is more than they could have gotten had they just gone to California, gotten married, and returned to Utah. So they will get federal rights and benefits, but the Utah Attorney General has said their marriage status is on hold in Utah, so they won't get state rights and benefits. And so, for instance, they will file their taxes in Utah, presumably as single, but file their taxes with the IRS as married.
The only people who will be happy are the tax representatives, accountants, I guess.
Right.
Did you expect this? Were you surprised by the Obama administration getting into this?
No, I wasn't surprised. Actually, this kind of decision from the administration is consistent with what the administration has been saying. Both rhetorically, they've been supporting same-sex couples' right to marry and trying to get federal rights and benefits to married same-sex couples. And in terms of what they did to implement the Supreme Court's decision striking down the Defense of Marriage Act, in all the places where the federal government has been able to argue that federal rights and benefits should be given to same-sex couples who are married, regardless of whether they live in a state that recognizes them as married, they've given those rights and benefits. So it was clear that they were going to have to say something, and that the Utah same-sex couples who got those marriage licenses were going to ask the federal government to recognize them. And I think it's consistent with what the government's done to actually say it will recognize them.
As other states take up this issue, and they will, what does this portend for them? Can they take a reading from this, a cue?
Well, we know that the federal, that the executive branch, at least, and the Obama administration supports same-sex couples' claims that the state has to allow them to marry. And so as cases get filed and as cases eventually go to the U.S. Supreme Court, I think we'll see the Solicitor General's office, for instance, weigh in as they did in the Proposition 8 litigation, to say that they agree with same-sex couples. But short of that, I don't think we're going to start seeing the administration taking positions in ongoing litigation, especially by actually filing anything in court. I think they're merely saying that if same-sex couples access marriage licenses, whether it's because the state allows them to or a court overturns a state ban, they're going to recognize those marriages.
And quickly, was this a rebuke to the Supreme Court in any way?
No, and I think the Supreme Court's decision to actually stay the effect of the district court opinion is actually not that surprising and doesn't tell us very much about what the Supreme Court thinks on the merits.
Okay, well, thank you, Doug Najame, attorney and law professor at UC Irvine.
Thank you.
In a moment, using marijuana legally in your own home can still get you fired from your job.
Like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
I'm Judy Muller, back with To The Point. A lot of states are watching Washington and Colorado as they launch their pot legalization laws. And now it looks as though Alaska may have a similar proposal on its August ballot. But the evolution towards legalization is a twisted path full of unexpected roadblocks. We begin our discussion today with the case of one man in Colorado, Brandon Coates. His case symbolizes both how far the country has come in terms of accepting marijuana and also how far it has to go. Even before Colorado legalized marijuana for recreational use, Coates had permission to use medical marijuana. He is a quadriplegic who used pot in his own home to alleviate pain. During the day, he worked as a customer service representative for the Dish Network. When his employers announced that workers would be drug tested, he was honest about his use of medicinal cannabis at home. And yet, when he tested positive, Dish Network fired him. Joining us now, John Ingold, a reporter for the Denver Post who covers federal courts and marijuana laws. Welcome, John.
Thank you for having me.
And you covered this case. Brandon Coates sued his employer. So where does that case stand now?
So what has happened is the trial court found against Mr. Coates, and the Colorado Court of Appeals, which is sort of the mid-step in the process, also found against Mr. Coates. So what has happened is that his attorneys have appealed up to the state Supreme Court, And we're awaiting to see whether the state Supreme Court is going to take that case or not.
Well, how did the appeals court come to that decision against him? What was their reasoning?
Sure. So one of the interesting things about the Coates case is that in Colorado we have something known as a lawful off-duties activities statute, which is designed to, it protects people who, like, say, smoke tobacco off the job. It says that, you know, things you do off the clock can't result in you being fired simply because you do them off the clock.
Especially if they're legal.
Correct.
Right.
So what he did is he challenged the firing under that statute and said, well, my medical marijuana use off the job, not being impaired on the job, is legal, and therefore I shouldn't have been fired. And what the court concluded, it was a split decision, but what the majority of the panel concluded was that because marijuana use, all marijuana use, regardless of the reason, is illegal federally, it therefore cannot be lawful for the purpose of this off-duty activity statute.
Well, I'm sure there are people who are listening who are wondering, well, why did he test positive? If he's using it at home, why did he test positive at work? Does THC stay in the bloodstream a while?
My understanding is that it was a urine test, which would show it would show past usage. It would show historical usage up to a certain period of time.
So that didn't mean he was impaired on the job, though?
Correct.
Huh. Yeah. And that didn't matter. He was fired anyway.
Yeah, not according to the court ruling.
Yeah. Wait, are other employers in Colorado paying attention to this? I'm sure they are.
Oh, certainly, yeah, yeah. It's been a fairly big area of interest for employers. There's been a lot of concern about what will happen, not just for medical marijuana, but now for any kind of marijuana, recreational marijuana, which voters approved here in 2012. And if, you know, employers need to tolerate that, both of the law that legalized medical marijuana and the law that legalized recreational marijuana have in their provisions that say employers don't have to tolerate marijuana in their workplace. And so it seems that the courts are now saying what that means is any kind of use of marijuana by their employers, whether it happens on the job or off the job.
Well, do you see a tension between the federal take on marijuana and the state's legalization? In other words, do employers worry about that contrast? Or do they bend to the federal statute more than they would the state?
Well, I think it depends on the employer. You know, we had a story just last month where we were talking to employers, and there are some folks who say it's not a big deal for them, that they don't care what their employees do off the clock as long as they're, you know, there and competent to perform their job when the day starts. But, you know, for a big employer, you know, and Dish employs quite a few people, it's certainly something that they've thought about, and they've adjusted their drug policies to make explicitly clear that marijuana is a part of them.
Well, also joining us now, Andrew Cohn, who is a legal analyst for CBS News and a contributing editor at The Atlantic. And I'm interested, Andrew, in what your take is on this case of Brandon Coates, which I know you followed.
Yeah, it's an interesting case, right? Because what you're seeing here is the difference between the science of marijuana as it affects the body and the science of alcohol as it affects the body.
Hmm.
Everyone's comfortable with the idea of alcohol. So you have these employees who are subject to drug testing in the workplace. They can go out, and on a Saturday night, they can get drunk as a skunk, doing whatever it is they're doing, and they can show up for work on Monday and be comfortable knowing that if they take a test, they are going to pass. They're not going to be considered, impaired because the alcohol will have left their system by the time they get to work. That same employee, if that employee is an adult and can otherwise get either medical marijuana or recreational marijuana, cannot take but a single puff of a joint or a single edible piece of cannabis without the fear that when that person goes to work on Monday, also sober, also able to do his or her job, that person isn't going to test poorly when the testing comes for marijuana. And that's because they haven't developed a test yet, right, that distinguishes between the levels of TLC, which is in marijuana, in the system. They can't evaluate when the marijuana came into the system as opposed to when it's still in the system. So you have all these people in Colorado, some of them I'm sure have talked to John, some of them have talked to me, who are law-abiding citizens, they're adults, they're otherwise available to use recreational marijuana. They have jobs, and they cannot use recreational marijuana because they fear that if they do, they will be tested, and employers will use this ruling so far from the Colorado Court of Appeals to basically say, sorry, you're out of luck. And so that's why I think there's a lot of pressure on the Colorado Supreme Court to try to issue a ruling in this case. There's also, I think, going to be some pressure put back on the state legislature to perhaps rethink the definition of this lawful activities test that is causing basically unequal protection when it comes to these uses.
You know, Americans have so dramatically changed their opinions about pot. A Gallup poll back in 1969 showed only 12% of the population favored legalization, and now 58% are in favor of marijuana legalization. So the trend's clear, but do we still suffer from this kind of schizophrenic stereotype about pot?
Well, we suffer. I mean, there's a couple of levels. I think the stereotype is changing as people of that generation die and young people come of age and begin to question the initial classification of marijuana as a class one substance on a par with heroin. That classification was always a little suspect. What's going to happen, or what's going to have to happen in Colorado, in Washington, as the states experiment with these laws, is that there's going to have to be a reckoning on the federal level with the Drug Enforcement Administration to reevaluate the science of the classification itself. Until that science is revised and updated to take into account the medicinal values of marijuana and other factors, you're going to have this, excuse me, this dichotomy, right, between the federal law that prohibits marijuana and still classifies it as unlawful and the states that don't. And that tension is obvious in Colorado, and I think it's one of the reasons why, despite the popularity of the new laws, we already see a store has run out of marijuana, we see millions of dollars in sales and a ton of revenue, there is going to be this reluctance on the part of law-abiding citizens to go forward. We're seeing it in the banking area, the commerce area, where federal lenders are a little concerned about getting involved in the marijuana industry for fear of seizure should the feds come in and clamp this down. It's not going to be able to stay in this limbo for long.
Right.
That's why there's so much at stake.
Well, I'd like to bring in Roger Ruffman at this point, because you mentioned the science and the studies about the impact of marijuana on people. And Roger is professor emeritus of social work at the University of Washington, and he studies addiction and is the co-sponsor, actually, of Washington's marijuana legalization bill. Welcome, Roger.
Thank you for having me.
You have an interesting take on cannabis, both personal and professional, and I want to get to that in a minute, but you do believe that marijuana can be harmful with heavy use. So what studies have you done to back that up?
Since the mid-1980s, my colleagues and I at the University of Washington have been testing ways of helping adults who are dependent on marijuana and finding it difficult to quit or cut back. More recently, we've also been doing that research with teenagers. And it's pretty clear from epidemiological research and people who study trends and what's happening in the population that a fairly substantial minority of users of marijuana become dependent on the drug and need some help in overcoming that dependence.
But let's talk about what it does to people who smoke at home or use it at home and then go to work the next day. Is that really impairment?
Yeah. So part of the issue, and John was just referring to this, Andrew was referring to this, is that we are stuck with a certain kind of stereotype that if there's THC in your system, in your body tissues, or for that matter, some of the metabolites, the breakdown products of THC, this must mean that you are being influenced in terms of your concentration, your memory, your motor performance. We've got a measurement problem, and we've got a stereotype of a problem. And I suspect that the science, as it improves measures that actually can say, if you have this kind of biological content in your system, this kind of profile of THC and metabolites in your system, It's crossing the line, and it's likely that you're impaired. And below that, you're not impaired. The science has got to get to that point of more accurate measure.
Right, and it isn't there yet. Right.
Not there yet. And then the laws need to catch up with that.
Okay, well, I want to bring in Curtis Graves now. He is an employment law attorney for the Mountain States Employers Council, and we're talking about on the job and the impact of marijuana smoking at home and coming into work. Curtis, what are the rights of employers here? Are there some jobs where you wouldn't want to hire someone who smokes pot at home on a regular basis?
Sure. You know, right now, the rights of employers are plenary. The employers have all the rights under Amendment 64 before retail sales went into effect, you know, as early as last year. The language states that employers are, nothing prohibits them from having and enforcing their drug policies. And so typically a drug policy will say we prohibit the use of these drugs, and marijuana is almost always on that list, and we will regard a positive test result as evidence of that usage, and we will act accordingly, you know, up to and including termination.
But if the science isn't there to justify that, is that old-fashioned? Is that playing into the old stereotype?
Well, absolutely. And I mean, you know, one of the questions no one's asking is, we're talking about urinalysis, which picks up this historical use as long as a month ago.
Oh.
But we already have better technologies like oral fluids, which may pick it up 2 to 4 days ago. So one might seasonably ask, why is an employer allowed to terminate based upon the usage of this one test when, you know, the language in the statutes refers to usage in the workplace? So we sort of have developed this legal fiction where someone testing positive in the workplace is treated as though it is equivalent to usage in the workplace.
Is there a concern that legalized pot could impact business in Colorado? What are you hearing about that?
It runs the gamut. And, you know, you had initially asked whether there were some employers who should be rightfully concerned. And I think the answer is yes. I mean, nobody wants to be on the road with someone driving an 18-wheeler who may be impaired. And in a case like that, I don't want to even hear the argument that he was using 2 weeks ago and isn't impaired right now. I don't want a scintilla of metabolites in that person's system if they're going to be sharing the road with me. But in the case of someone like Brandon Coates, who is the poster child for this whole debate, who was apparently doing a good job, he's a quadriplegic, he's not using at work, and he gets terminated anyway, perhaps the analysis should be a little different. So, you know, zero tolerance makes sense in certain safety-sensitive occupations, less sense in non-safety-sensitive occupations.
Roger Ruffman of the University of Washington, would you agree with that?
I do. And I think, you know, we're on an accelerated trajectory to better understanding the effects of marijuana on performance and kind of getting past some of the old stereotypes. And I think part of the reason we're accelerating is that we don't have war on drugs rhetoric now that we're legalizing marijuana, first medically in a number of states, 21 states, and now recreationally in 2 states. You know, during the war on marijuana, it just was not acceptable to talk about marijuana use as something that could be occasional, safe, moderate, healthy, perhaps even enrich life. If anything, what we saw in the media and in much of science was a focus on pathology and damage and harm and risk.
Right.
I think we're going to see a faster pace of increasing our appreciation of the full spectrum of marijuana,
okay,
both harms and benefits, and instances in which really there are no adverse consequences.
Right. Well, we're talking about the pitfalls in the legalization of marijuana, including the risk of being fired by your employer, and we'll continue the conversation after a brief break. Later on today's Talking Point, TV characters behaving badly and why we watch them. Back in a minute with To the Point from PRI.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
I'm Judy Muller, sitting in for Warren Olney today on To The Point. We're talking about the pitfalls in the legalization of marijuana, including the possibility of being fired by your employer if you fail a drug test, which is just what happened to quadriplegic Brandon Coates in Colorado. He was using medicinal pot in the privacy of his home, but he failed a drug test, prompted his employer to fire him. Curtis Graves, employment law attorney for the Mountain States Employers Council. Why on earth would that man have been fired? Did the Dish Network take a lot of heat for that?
They certainly did, and they continue to. But they're not the only ones. I mean, the reason he's fired is they have a policy, and it says the consequences of testing positive for these drugs is termination. And, you know, they hadn't thought far enough ahead, perhaps, to see that someone like Brandon Coates might come up, but they're simply enforcing their policy and having to balance that with, you know, taking a one-off for him. And at that point, you know, the credibility of their whole policy crumbles if they don't enforce it across the board.
Which is zero tolerance, basically.
Right.
John Ingold, a reporter for the Denver Post, you followed this story. Are other workers as well as employers watching this case to see how they should behave? And will the finer points of legalization end up being hammered out in the courts rather than on the ground in the workplace?
I think that's fair to say. We did a story after the start of recreational marijuana sales here in Colorado, which started just on New Year's Day, looking at whether marijuana has lost its stigma, whether people who have never used before, or whether they were used a long time ago, whether people were going to start now coming back and starting to use marijuana again. And what we found is that a lot of people, even those who were thinking about doing that, didn't want to talk to us because they were quite concerned about the consequences with their employer.
Huh. Andrew Cohn, legal analyst for CBS News and contributing editor to The Atlantic. What about privacy rights versus employer rights? Is that going to be a conflict always there?
Yeah, I think so. I do. I think so. And I think that, you know, the best argument that Coates had was, I was honest. I was never reprimanded for smoking on the job. I told my employers what I needed to tell them. I gave up, in other words, a measure of my privacy in recognition of the need that I have as a quadriplegic to have medical marijuana. And that's why I think his case is so compelling. Now, other people aren't going to have the same sorts of facts on their side to be able to make those cases. But again, I think it's something the Colorado courts are going to have to deal with. I think it's something that the state legislature ultimately is going to have to revisit. You know, I think that in the move from Colorado to balance the permission they got from voters to legalize recreational marijuana, there has been a great deal of regulation, a great deal of going slow, realizing that everyone in the nation is watching, and we have to go slow and we have to take these incremental steps. And it'll be interesting to see how incremental those steps stay as they begin to be challenged in the court and in the courts of public opinion. And I think we're way too early in this experiment to know exactly how that's all going to play out. I think the really interesting thing here, as John sort of mentioned, it's been 6 months since the Colorado Supreme Court got the possibility of taking this case.
And why are they taking so long?
Well, I think they're taking a long time because they want to see the way the sort of the political wind blows and the economic wind blows and the, you know, the marijuana wind blows. And I think eventually they're going to have to fish or cut bait. Eventually they're going to have to decide whether they're going to take the case or not. I think this is generally a pro-employer state. I think employers have a lot of rights to determine the conditions of employment. I don't think this is a state that's going to contemplate doing away with these tests altogether. But again, I think there's probably going to be pressure to figure out a way to calculate it so that people who lawfully in Colorado use marijuana can still have jobs and still be able to prove to their employers that when they get to work on Monday, they're as sober as the person who may have gotten drunk on Friday or Saturday.
Right. Well, you know, Colorado is my home state, and I was there January 1st on this historic day and saw people lining up around the block everywhere to be the first to buy legal marijuana. And I have to say, it looked like a very successful, you know, business venture, at the very least. I've heard that some shops have run out of marijuana. Is that true?
Well, John is the expert.
John?
We defer to John, who has...
John Ingold?
That actually is true. There's been, I'd say, a small number, maybe one or two, that have kind of completely run out of marijuana from their recreational marijuana inventories. There's also a lot of stores will sell marijuana-infused food products. Uh-huh. They're kind of known as edibles here in Colorado. And there's been a pretty widespread shortage of edibles. A lot of stores have sold out of those.
And really, the sentiment is not uniform throughout Colorado, is it, about this? So they're trying to be very careful on how this is instituted, correct? Because not everybody's in favor of this.
Sure, absolutely. The governor, for one, was not in favor of the measure back in November of 2012.
Roger Rothman, expert in alcohol and substance abuse and co-sponsor of the Washington legalization law, I'm wondering how you are reacting, watching as Colorado First unfolds its legal pot shops. You guys are following soon, I understand. What are you seeing that they're doing right, and what worries you?
Well, you know, I think Colorado voters had the right idea in general, but I wouldn't give the writers of Amendment 64 a grade of A. Maybe I'm looking a little bit egotistically at the Washington Initiative in comparison. Here's the difference. Colorado really recognized that the criminal prohibition was not working. It was wasteful. It was fueling the illicit economy. Regulating and taxing offered a greater chance for health and safety. But what it didn't do, and what Washington did do, was to specifically earmark a large amount of excise tax revenue that this industry will bring in for public education on marijuana, for prevention tailored towards young people, for treatment, for research and evaluation. So, you know, ultimately, we've got two different models, both of which are addressing a pretty failed policy, one of which I think is more of a public health alternative to criminal prohibition than the other. And we've got a fascinating experiment unfolding here in terms of how are we going to see the impact on health and safety, on youth access, youth use, on dependence, the use of health facilities, traffic accidents. The next few years are absolutely going to be fascinating to be tuned into these two states.
I think your position is fascinating because you see all of this, you see the problems with it, and yet you were the co-sponsor of the measure that passed there. And you had a personal experience with marijuana early in your life, correct?
Yeah, so, you know, I knew nothing about marijuana when I started to do research on it. I was an Army social worker in Vietnam in 1967, and a lot of American troops were smoking marijuana, and I ended up doing the initial surveys of marijuana use. The experience of beginning to learn about marijuana pushed me in the direction of becoming a drug researcher. And I've come to appreciate the intense impact of symbolism on how people think about marijuana and other drugs, equally powerful to the actual facts about how the drugs work. And what I ultimately came to decide in becoming a sponsor of Initiative 502 in the state of Washington was, It offers us not only a chance to undo some of the harms from prohibition, but it offers us a chance to become a more adequately informed public about the truth of marijuana and its reality, the full spectrum of information, the good, the bad, the ugly. And I think with greater information, we're likely to see healthier norms develop among mm-hmm. individuals for use, and ultimately a safer, healthier society.
Curtis Graves, employment law attorney for the Mountain States Employers Council, I know you have to leave us. I'm just curious, what do other employers do now? If the federal law changes, there'll be a lot of lawsuits. I mean, are employers feeling kind of handcuffed in between?
Well, you know, we've been through this before. We had medical marijuana, many people don't realize, since 2001. It didn't gain steam here until 2009 after the Attorney General's office, you know, articulated their hands-off approach as long as people were abiding by state law. And again, we went through this last year when the legislation first passed. So I don't see a lot of people doing a lot differently. And we serve about 3,000 Colorado employers, so we've got a pretty good cross-section. You know, most employers by now understand what their rights are. And to an earlier point, it's not likely that employers are suddenly going to start drug testing people who are already employed with them, you know, when they show up on a Monday morning. Now, under Colorado law, they would have that right. But most employers just want the job done adequately. And if people are coming to work and not showing signs of reasonable suspicion and they've already passed a pre-employment drug test, then for most people, it's going to be business as usual.
And Andrew Cohn, legal analyst for CBS News, I'm curious what you think will happen next across the country. Do you think that the examples of Colorado and Washington are going to spur even more legalization measures in other states?
Well, I mean, already we're seeing Alaska look at it. I guess there's going to be a vote in August. I think a lot is going to depend on how the federal government reacts, right? The administration, the Justice Department, Eric Holder, they have tolerated the experiments that are going on in Washington and Colorado. They have warned regulators in those states, listen, this is still a violation of federal law. This is still a class one substance. We are not going to change our views on that. We're going to allow this to proceed. And if we perceive that the regulations are not protecting citizens, if they're especially not protecting young people, elderly people, if they're raising crime rates, we're going to come back and crack down. Until the federal government makes a move one way or the other in that direction, I think states are going to be reluctant. On the other hand, Colorado is going to be raking in the money pretty soon, already is. Washington is going to be raking in the money pretty soon. There's obviously a demand for this. There's obviously strong public support for it. And there's also, you know, 20 years of experience with medical marijuana in many states, right? More than a third of the states of the nation, and the sky hasn't fallen in those states. There hasn't been rampant drug use. There hasn't been, you know, rampant rises in crime. And the other thing to remember here is there is strong conservative support. The National Review this week came out in favor of legalization. So you have bipartisan support for the solution that's going to reduce the cost of prisons, right? Because so many people now in prisons are there in prison for marijuana possession, dealing, that kind of stuff. So there's this, you know, this is a symptom, I would say, of a larger change that we're seeing over the past few years. The financial and the economic costs of incarceration, mass incarceration, the racial disparities in marijuana sentencing, all of that is coalescing with this solution that the government's going to look at. So 6 months down the road, if the feds say, you know what, so far we're satisfied or so far we're pleased, if the feds say, you know what, we're going to direct the DEA to undertake a review of the classification, that's going to be a signal to the states, other states that want to get this revenue, and then I think you're just going to see an opening of the floodgates.
So very quickly, those of you who are still with me, a quick prediction of what's going to happen to Brandon Coates and his case, and how would you predict that coming out? Let's start with John Ingold, reporter for the Denver Post.
Oh, I try to avoid making predictions.
Okay, I can understand that.
It's difficult to say. You know, if the state Supreme Court chooses not to take the case, then the Court of Appeals decision would end up being the law of the land. It is now, and it would be sort of cemented that way. And if they do take the case, it's hard to say why they would be doing that. So.
And the law of the land then would be the federal government calls this an illegal substance, and the employer has the right to bend to that law, correct?
Right, yes.
Okay. So, Andrew Cohn, how do you think it'll come out?
See, I'm the legal analyst where poor John is, you know, the reporter, the correspondent, so I can make a prediction.
Okay.
I think Brandon Coates loses in the short term.
Ooh.
I think he wins in the long term. I don't know how long that term is. I don't know if it's 6 months or a year, but at some point, people like Brandon Coates, who are honest, who are sober, who are getting satisfactory and adequate performance reviews at work will not be prohibited from smoking marijuana. I just can't tell you exactly when that's going to happen.
And Roger Rothman of the University of Washington, I know this isn't your case, but what would you say as a prediction for Brandon Coates?
I'm not a lawyer, nor do I play one on television. I'm just going to give you my own personal hope, and that he wins in the short term, and that we all win in the long term. A saner, more compassionate, more accurate, reality-based and accurate appraisal of just where the public good is served in terms of what employers do.
And Curtis Graves, you're with the Mountain States Employers Council. What would you say? Oh, he's gone. Well, I'm sorry we missed him. But I thank him for having joined us, as well as our other guests, John Ingold with the Denver Post, Roger Rothman with the University of Washington, and Andrew Cohn, senior legal analyst for CBS News. Coming up, shameless characters on TV and why we watch them. Back with more on To the Point from PRI in a moment.
Have you checked out the KCRW iPad app? It's called The Music Mine. Stream music handpicked by our DJs, watch live performances, and find new music. See why iTunes calls it an essential app for music discovery. Download and learn more at kcrw.com/musicmine.
I'm Judy Muller, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with today's Talking Point. On Sunday, two shows return to the airwaves, the HBO series Girls, and over on Showtime, the series Shameless. Girls features a main character, Hannah, a 24-year-old woman living in New York who is so self-absorbed and so self-sabotaging that we can't quite believe we're tuning in to watch. And yet we do. Shameless is the American version of the British drama of the same name, featuring the Gallagher clan of Chicago. They deal with lying, stealing, alcoholism, prurient sex. Well, you get the picture. In the words of critic Hank Stuever of The Washington Post, Shameless is held together by a sort of G. Officer Krupke's sense of morality. They're depraved on account of they're deprived. Whereas in Girls, they're depraved on account of they went to Oberlin. It's a great line. And welcome, Hank.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Why is despicable behavior now the key character trait for our protagonist? When did this start happening?
Oh, probably everyone likes to point to The Sopranos, I would guess, more than a decade ago now.
What about Seinfeld? I was thinking about Seinfeld. They're sort of petty.
That's actually a good point. Let's go back a little further. Everybody's struggle with decent manners from Larry David's mind and Jerry Seinfeld's mind. Those characters certainly taught us that, okay, characters are flawed, and they're much more interesting when they're flawed, and they're much more interesting when they make bad choices. Now it's 2014. I think that television viewers have had to become highly calibrated detectors of how much despicableness they can take. And what works for one show and for one viewer does not necessarily work to the next show for the same viewer. You can say, oh, I don't watch that show because I just can't stand blank, the character.
Can we fill in that blank for you, which would be Hannah and Girls?
Well, I do think I'm at a point where I might have to, professionally, I'll have to always keep watching Girls.
Oh, dear.
It is part of a conversation, but I do give people permission that if you've had enough of Hannah, if you see only her selfishness, which I think is what they want you to see, but you just can't take it, you can move on. And that doesn't mean that you're too old or too unhip or sexist or a variety of things you could be for not liking Girls. I think it comes with this supposition that it is transmitting messages about a generation, and if you don't get it, you don't get it, and it probably has something to do with your age. I don't buy that. I think that we bail on TV shows all the time because we don't like the characters.
Okay, well, let's go back to your remarks about The Sopranos. Tony Soprano actually murdered people, but we still liked him. Walter White murders people.
Oh yeah,
in Breaking Bad, and we still like him. I mean, what is this?
It's interesting that you bring that up, because actually yesterday in Pasadena at the Winter Press Tour, which I should say I'm not at, I'm missing it this time out, but HBO was there, and Girls had a panel. And Lena Dunham, the creator and star of Girls, pointed that out. She's like, well, you don't like Hannah, but you certainly seem to be okay with Walter White, or she said something to that effect. Mm-hmm. I guess if I was there, I would have said back, well, I think Walter did more. There was just more going on. There was more complexity and more context for me to decide whether or not I was rooting for him or against him,
Isn't it also true that good villains, well-written villains, have always been more interesting? I'm thinking of Elmore Leonard and his characters in Justified, for example. Mm-hmm. Some wonderful mm-hmm. villains in that show. And we're drawn to watching them. Whether we root for them or not is another question, mm-hmm. but that they're interesting mm-hmm. in a way. Is that part of this?
It is part of that. I think that is a new, relatively new narrative device in which you have sort of despicable protagonists who actually come up against people who are worse than them. Boardwalk Empire is kind of good at doing this. Every season there's been someone who's been a little bit worse than Nucky who is mm-hmm. messing up Nucky's world, there are a lot of shows where it's like, wow, well, the person that Walter White is fighting against is actually worse than Walter White. And there's a clear delineation. With these sort of more portraiture-like shows, like Girls, you're just sort of like, I think we're just working out a mass sort of exercise in that's not okay. Why is she doing that? Why would she behave that way? Why did she take that $20 that was meant for the hotel maid, like the little things. It's like the little kind of almost advice column things that we get more upset about than the brutal violence and the point blank shots to the head.
You referred to a generation gap in terms of that show, and I have to say mm-hmm. when I watch it, I think, am I supposed to believe that people in their 20s are like this? I don't want to believe that.
I think the best criticism of the show is actually that sketch that Tina Fey did on Saturday Night Live a few months ago where she played Blurta, the new friend of the girls who was from an Eastern Bloc, formerly Eastern Bloc nation. And, Hannah's upset about something and Blurta in her accent says, there, you are only 15. And she's like, I'm 24. And Blurta's shocked. I think that the show gets on older generation's nerves simply because we can't imagine anybody being that inept at 24, even if possibly we were.
But Lena Dunham must believe that it's characteristic, or she wouldn't. She writes that show, so her main character.
She does. She's the showrunner. I do think she is exercising some documentary portraiture there. She's calling together things and that she hears and reads and people she knows and sees, and she's presenting it. And I do think it's sort of totemic, and it does sort of represent a generation. She has certainly attracted a lot of attention for it, not only from her own generation, but from others.
Well, let's talk about Shameless a little bit. It's not a show I watch, so you may have to help me here. But what is it that you like about it, which you clearly do in your critique mm-hmm. today?
I've always liked it. And it struck me while I was trying to get a handle on why I don't like Girls anymore. Why haven't I spent the same sort of mental energy and intellectual energy trying to give Shameless a boost here and there? I'm always telling people to go back and watch it. Now, I didn't watch the British one as much. I do like the what they've done with it as an American show. The Gallaghers are terrible people. They're just terrible, terrible people. But they have found that balance in the writing and the acting in which you understand why they're terrible. Hmm. It's a much more complex situational ethics going on. And it's hard to take. And you're like, sometimes you see things that you can see them coming a mile away. You're like, that child is not going to go use the bathroom. He is going to pee out the window. He should not do that. And that's like a very minor transgression in the scheme of the Gallaghers. But I just think the show has a really great balance. I think it's really well performed, well written, well structured. Joan Cusack has done tremendous work in that show. And so while I was writing about Girls, I'm like, really all this energy, I should be writing about Shameless.
Well, maybe it doesn't have anything to do with the despicability of the characters as much as it does as good writing. I mean, yeah. And good plotting and carrying us along with a good story. Maybe
yeah,
that's
and I'm afraid we could take a whole hour trying to decide if Girls is well written or not.
Well, going back as we said, to Seinfeld in comedy and The Sopranos in drama. Mm-hmm. And, of course, The Wire had a lot of great villains, too. But are we seeing a trend this way? I mean, there were 20 years ago, would we have, you know, we're certainly not seeing Ozzy and Harriet anymore. Is there a trend towards seeing the good, the bad, and the ugly all the time?
Pretty much. In fact, I have to rack my brain to think of shows where it's really only about likable people. I would say Call the Midwife on PBS.
They are so nice.
They are all likable. I like them all. Even the ones that are supposed to be kind of unlikable, I like. And that they don't even remotely approach the level. Of course, the show is set in the 50s. But, you know, somebody said, well, Tremé was full of likable people. And I agree with that.
Yeah, but they're not likable like The Midwife. Those are British likable.
Yeah, I know.
It's just a whole different breed.
I know. And, you know, I mean, I'm always looking for a show where I can just like the people in the show. But, you know, I'd hate to corner myself off and you know, only watch Hallmark movies at the same time. I really like the Rascals. I really like the Despicable People, too.
Even in reality television, I mean, I don't watch much, but I know that they create villains. They're horrible. I mean, and people tune in just to watch whether they get theirs or not, you know?
Yeah.
It's a gimmick.
It's a gimmick. I think people are kind of—I think that the recent falderall over Duck Dynasty, I think people have— shown themselves to be a lot wiser about reality television than we usually give viewers credit for. I don't think it's going away anytime soon, but you know, I think that it's manipulative to the people in it. It's manipulative to the watchers of it. But that's a different definition of despicable.
Okay. We love Despicable, though. It's clear. Maybe there'd be a show called The Despicables. This would be good.
Maybe we'll go through some great cultural redemption phase where we, you know, we just love one another.
The Admirables.
Right. Yeah, the okay. Admirables. Oh, well, that's a new show next spring.
Hank Stuever, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Hank Stuever, TV critic for The Washington Post. To the Point was produced this week by Andrea Brody, Katie Cooper, Evan George, Benjamin Gottlieb, Jenny Hamill, Caitlin Schamberg, and Kareem Maddox. The technical director is Mike Newport. The managing producer is Sonia Geis. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. I'm Judy Muller, filling in for Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.